From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Prison Life magazine, the publication advertised as the voice of the convict. It has regular features like in-cell cooking and cellmate of the month, gives legal, health, and medical advice, and covers the issues of the day. We'll talk with the editor and publisher, Richard Stratton. Like several members of the staff, he's an ex-con. He served 8 years for smuggling marijuana. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's Emmys and previews the fall television season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. NATO is denying Bosnian Serb charges of civilian casualties from cruise missile attacks yesterday. NATO says it used Tomahawk missiles instead of ordering more bombing attacks because the weather was so bad. NATO Commander Admiral Leighton Smith says the military alliance has never and will never target civilians.
There is no way in which we would ever take action that in any way, even as a side issue, would risk damaging civilians or injuring civilians. We will always take the utmost care to minimize the risk of collateral damage, including the damage to civilians. I have to say, as I've said previously, we can never totally eliminate that risk.
NATO is continuing its bombing raids today without cruise missiles. Warplanes report they've been shot at with shoulder-launched missiles and anti-aircraft artillery. No shootdowns are reported. An emergency meeting between Russian and NATO officials doesn't appear to have ended a dispute over the use of bombing attacks on Bosnian Serbs. Russian envoy Vitaly Churkin says his two-hour meeting with NATO officials today didn't resolve the problem. Churkin says Russia is worried NATO's bombing runs could inflame tensions that all sides have been working to settle. French commandos arrested 40 people in raids early this morning throughout the country. Police are trying to find those responsible for a bombing campaign that has killed 7 people since July. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Crack French forces, dressed in black from head to toe, with their faces covered, raided tenement districts in Paris and the provinces. One of the raids was against a residence for Arab immigrants in Grenoble in the Alps. Police say the prime suspect in the bombing campaign, a 24-year-old man born in Algeria, had stayed there overnight, but he wasn't there. Police say they found the fingerprints of the man on a bomb that was placed on a high-speed railway track in August. The bomb failed to go off. The government has stepped up security throughout the country to the point of virtually declaring a state of siege. The army's been brought in to patrol key monuments and airports. Last night, President Jacques Chirac said more troops would be mobilized. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Astronauts aboard the space shuttle Endeavour have placed a satellite into orbit. It took several frustrating hours to get it there. NASA skipped its first chance to release the satellite early this morning after communication problems developed. More problems cropped up during the second opportunity, but NASA engineers resent a series of computer commands, and the satellite was eventually deployed. The Wake Shield Facility satellite will make semiconductor film in zero gravity. Physicists believe the film produced in space should be faster and consume less power than silicon film now used in computers and other electronics. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 16.5 points at 47.17. This is NPR. A new study finds lung cancer is killing more women than ever. Researchers from the American Cancer Society say the number of female smokers dying of lung cancer soared sixfold between the 1960s and the 1980s. During the same time period, lung cancer deaths among men nearly doubled. The study, printed in the American Journal of Public Health, also finds that lung cancer has passed heart disease as the leading cause of smoking-related deaths among white middle-class smokers. Algerian newspaper journalists have begun a 3-day strike. They're protesting continuing assaults against them. NPR's Suni Khaled reports.
The Newspaper Editors Association called upon the Algerian government to increase its protection of journalists. Last week, 4 Algerian journalists were killed in political violence. Reporters and columnists have been increasingly caught in the middle of the country's 3-year civil war. About 50 journalists and media employees have been killed the last 2 years. They have been targeted by Muslim extremist groups for allegedly supporting the country's military-backed regime. At the same time, they have been restricted by the government from reporting on security matters. More than 40,000 people have been killed since Algeria's military regime canceled multi-party elections and banned the country's leading Muslim political party. I'm Sunni Khalid in Cairo.
A Russian lawmaker who was hit during a brawl on the floor of the Russian parliament says she'll sue ultranationalist leader Vladimir Zhirinovsky for physical and moral damage. Yevgenia Tishkovskaya says Zhirinovsky grabbed her hair, tried to strangle her, hit her, and injured her finger. She plans to seek money damages, and she wants the lower house of parliament to lift Zhirinovsky's parliamentary immunity. The Speaker of the Parliament, or the Duma, has asked prosecutors to investigate ultranationalist lawmakers in connection with the fight. There have been scuffles in the past, but Russian observers say this was the worst one ever. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard Stratton, is the editor-in-chief of Prison Life magazine. It's advertised as the voice of the convict, the only national magazine by and for prisoners. But Stratton says the magazine also has the mission of educating people in the free world about life inside. In a typical issue, you'll find stories about prisoner rights, profiles of prisoners, prison art and writing contests, and advice columns for inmates. Many of the key members of the staff are ex-convicts. Richard Stratton served 8 years in federal prison for smuggling marijuana. Before taking over Prison Life magazine, he edited the quarterly publication of the prisoners' advocacy group, the Fortune Society. About 40% of Prison Life's subscribers are behind bars. Stratton would like to reach more prisoners. I told him I thought one obstacle he must face is that many prisoners can't read.
I think the number one cause of crime in America is illiteracy. However, there are also, prison turns out to be one of the last great depositories or reservoirs of readers, on the other hand. People who never read on the street, when they get to prison, they end up reading a lot because they find themselves locked in a cell for at least 8 to 10 hours a day with nothing else to do. So there are a lot of readers there, and it's a curious thing. You have, on the one hand, some very literate, intelligent people, and then you have people with no education at all who have a tremendous amount of natural gifts, poetic gifts, all kinds of different creative talents that are locked up in there and have never had any way to express that except, unfortunately, in criminal behavior. And we hope that the magazine will bridge that gap and get some of these people to express themselves in creative ways that are not destructive to society.
I get solicited all the time in the mail to subscribe to magazines. How do you solicit people in prison to subscribe to yours?
The way we've been doing it is, to a certain degree, we have tried to acquire various lists of other organizations that are involved with prison reform, such as Families Against Mandatory Minimums, Julie Stewart's organization in Washington, D.C., and other prison reform activist groups. But by and large, what's happened is that the word of mouth in prison is an incredibly powerful force. There's a grapevine that exists that goes through all the prisons of this country. A lot of times I hear news from people who call me from prisons before I read about it in the papers. So the word of mouth has been a big thing that's kind of brought the story of Prison Life magazine to other prisoners and made them interested enough to write to us and ask for a sample copy, which we send them. And also we have a lot of just subscription forms in the magazine, and we know for sure that there's a tremendous pass-around rate in prison. It's like at least 10 to 1. In fact, I met some guy the other day who just got out of prison who was telling me that where he was, they had sort of on each wing or each tier, they had a guy who was like the designated Prison Life magazine subscriber. And then they had a list of names, and they had a certain number of days that each person was able to hold the magazine before they passed it on to the next name on the list. So as he's telling me all this, I said, why didn't you just tell these guys to subscribe to the magazine? I'm sure they can spend a little less on junk food 1 week and subscribe to the magazine. But that's the way it works in prison. It's, when you're living at such close quarters with people, you can depend on them to lend you their magazines and newspapers.
Describe what a typical issue of Prison Life is like, the types of stories you're likely to cover.
Well, we try to do a variety of stories. We try to do at least one what we call service story, and that would be a story that would help people in prison to cope with or deal with a variety of issues that come up, such as I'm trying to get someone to write me a piece about aging, you know, when you're doing like life and you see yourself getting older and older and older and how you cope with the aging process in prison. So we try to do, as I say, a service piece that would be of interest to prisoners, but also non-prisoners in that they could kind of compare. You know, we such as will say, well, you know, maybe you can't get the minoxidil when your hair starts falling out, but you can take better care of yourself and you don't have to have the paunch that the maybe average 40 or 50-year-old man might get when he's on the street. So that's the kind of piece we look at. I've just assigned another piece for someone to write a story on the whole, which is segregation or solitary confinement, and we want to probably do an interview with a professor up at Harvard who is one of the foremost experts on that. I'm trying to get an interview with Marion Barry. We want to do a story on Mayor Barry, and his office has actually said that the mayor would do the interview, and we're trying to schedule it now. I'd love to do a story on Nelson Mandela, and probably will. So there's always those kinds of stories, too. Prisoners or former prisoners who've come out and done extraordinary things.
Prison life has a number of regular features. There's a cooking feature called In Cell Cooking, a feature called a Tattoo of the Month, where there's a photograph or drawing of somebody's tattooed body. You have Ask the Nurse, which is your health feature. Tell us a little bit about the In Cell Cooking feature.
In-cell cooking is, we saw it as kind of semi-humorous, but it's, again, it's one of these pieces that could definitely be service piece for people who are locked up, who are trying to think of ways to spice up the bland prison diet that they get in the chow hall, and they can buy certain things from the commissary and then bring them back to their cells and cook them up in a variety of ways that convicts know about cooking in prisons, such as what they call the bomb, which is when you pack toilet paper very, very close together and then light it, and it smolders and creates a little stove effect. And then there's a stinger, which is a wire that's the two exposed ends are attached to a spoon. It's a very dangerous thing. It kind of blows fuses a lot, but and then stuck in water and makes it boil quickly. So the recipes that you find in cell cooking lend themselves to people who might be cooking in their cell, or like students who are living in a dormitory room, or traveling salesmen living in motel rooms. And it's surprising how much play that calm. When we first put it in there, we thought, well, we'll put this in because it's amusing. We kept getting these recipes. But it's amazing how many people have been just so interested in that particular calm. I suppose it's because people love to eat.
Is it hard for you to find advertisers for prison life?
Is it hard? It's not. Let's put it this way. It has not been as good yet as we hope it will be, although it seems to be. Advertising is the part of the magazine that seems to be growing the fastest right now.
Let me say that, for the prisoners inside, unless something's mail order, there's no way they're going to be able to buy the advertiser's product.
That's right.
Except for things like, are cigarettes on sale in the canteen?
Cigarettes are definitely on sale, and our biggest advertiser is Newport's.
Right.
Yeah, the people who sell through the commissary, the various companies that sell things that are available through commissaries, those are probably the main source of advertising. But now Polygram Records just came in for three insertions because people in prison buy a lot of CDs and tapes and stuff like that to listen to. What we're doing now, and this is the thing that finally, we've got our own in-house advertising sales, which we never had before, and we got an ex-convict, and that's what we needed all along. I kept saying, we need somebody who knows what products are available in prison and how to go about getting those people, and that's what we've got now. We just started with this, and he's been going around and getting the names of all the different companies that are approved to sell products in various prisons, and then we're going directly to them. And as soon as they hear about us, they say, oh yeah, we'd love to advertise. That's our market.
I think one of the most unusual ads I've seen in your magazine is for a learn-to-juggle kit featuring specially designed balls that will not bounce or roll out of your cell door when dropped. And the headline reads, "Learn to juggle, be the first on your block with more balls than most. Great new healthy way to kill time." A clever ad.
Clever ad. Someone with a sense of humor, and that's what we like.
You think a lot of guys or women in prison send away for this?
I don't know. I think this is our like second or third time that they run the ad, so they must be getting some good response. I know that the people who sell T-shirts are having a great response, and some of the other people have written in and called us up and said, "Oh, I'm getting a lot of response. I'm going to make it, go for a bigger ad, have a contract for a bigger ad." Lawyers, a lot of the lawyers who advertise have heard from many people.
You solicit comments about your magazine and about prison life from your prisoner readers. What are some of the typical things that you're hearing now about prison life? What are some of the themes that are emerging from the people who write you?
Probably the main theme that's emerging right now is how prison life is really far from the sort of country club resort environment that that is being cracked up to be in such national publications as the Reader's Digest. They just did a big story a little while ago about why must our prisons be resorts, and we countered that and saying why must the public be misled. The prisons in this country are so overcrowded and so miserable in many, many ways that to think of then punishing people even more by trying to make the conditions harsher, I think, is a big mistake. And a lot of the people who are in prison think that, too, including, I would add, wardens and administrators who have come out and deathly opposed to these political remedies that have been emanating out of Washington. The major story that's coming up that we're working on right now is the Alabama chain gang. That's probably the most blatant example of, you know, just going back to this kind of harsh treatment that never worked in the past and expecting it to work now. That's the main thing that comes out. The other thing that most prisoners write about is that they just feel that the public is being given all the wrong information about crime and punishment in the United States, and that they don't really understand the issues, and that if they did, they would change their attitudes. So
another thing that I think has emerged, at least from the letters I've read, is that a lot of prisoners seem to feel that their spouses or lovers or family turn their backs on the prisoners after the person has been in prison for a while.
Well, that's true. And to a large degree, it's inevitable. It's, you know, life goes on, and it's very difficult. I keep telling people in prison, you know, you're on convict time, you're on prison time, you don't understand what it's like to be out here. And then they say, oh, you know, I wish I were out there. Of course they wish they were out there, but I remember when I was in prison, I'd have lists of things that I wanted friends or loved ones to do, and I'd call back a day or two later and couldn't understand why they hadn't done all these things. But the reason they hadn't was because they had many, many other things to do, including paying bills and holding down a job, all of which you don't really have to do in prison. But it's true that there is a tremendous amount of alienation that seeps into just about every relationship when a person is going through long-term incarceration. It's just really hard to keep up those family ties.
My guest is Richard Stratton, editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Richard Stratton, editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. You did time in prison. How much of your staff has done time?
Let's see. I would say that probably 80% of the staff has done time. We have a woman working for us who's the managing editor, Jennifer Wynn, who's never done time in prison but who teaches a journalism course in prison. And then my executive editor, Chris Cazone has not done time in prison either, but he grew up in a neighborhood where most everyone did and didn't because he got involved in journalism.
And the founder of the magazine, I believe, ran the commissary at Danville State Prison in Illinois.
Right.
What did you serve time for?
I served 8 years of a 25-year non-parolable sentence for smuggling marijuana. And then after 6 years, my sentence was vacated by an appellate court because it was illegally imposed, and I got resentenced to what turned out to be 10 years and got out after 8.
What prisons did you do time in?
I started out in Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. I was there for about 3 months while they were designating me. I was in the K dorm. I was in MCC New York, which is the huge high-rise federal detention center downtown where they take all the famous criminals. And then I went to Petersburg, Virginia, which was a maximum security federal prison in Virginia. And as my security level dropped, they sent me up to Raybrook, New York, and finally I was released from Ashland, Kentucky.
What were the best and worst conditions you faced during the years that you were in prison?
The worst conditions that I faced were at a county jail in a major metropolitan city. The name of the prison is the Glass House, was the nickname for it. Without a doubt, the worst prison I think I've ever seen anywhere. Conditions were just unbelievable. There was 100-some-odd men locked in a room with 3 broken and flooded toilets in the middle, and they never shut the lights out, and people were just right off the streets and thrown into this environment, and it was incredible. I spent 3 days there before they put me into the federal system. That was without a doubt the worst. As far as the best prisons I've ever been, I think probably the higher security, the maximum security penitentiaries, contrary to popular belief, are the best in that they tend to be less overcrowded than the lower levels, lower security levels. They're still overcrowded, and a lot of them have gone to double bunks where they used to be single, and some have even gone to triple bunks in cells that are made for one man. But the maximum security prisons tend to be better if you're doing a lot of time because, by and large, they leave you alone. They respect you. I mean, both prisoners and the guards, they know that if a guy's doing life with no parole, that, you know, they don't want to hassle him for too little.
What's the most overcrowded condition you are in?
Well, when I got short, as they say, just before I was getting out, when I was in Ashland, Kentucky, they put me in a dormitory situation where literally you rolled over and, you know, someone else's feet were in your face. It was just bunk after bunk after bunk with no privacy at all. You know, you could hear guys like whispering in their sleep and rustling in their beds. And again, you know, toilets flushing all night because the bathroom is right there. It was incredible. I spent like close to a year living like that.
Now, you were convicted of smuggling marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any drug problems when you were imprisoned?
Drug problems? No. You mean as far as drug addiction?
Yeah.
No. I mean, I've never really particularly used any drug other than marijuana. And I started smoking that when I was in high school back in the 60s. So I never had any real drug problems. Drugs are rampant in prison. I mean, I saw more drugs in prison than I ever saw on the street. I saw, I'd never seen or used heroin, but I started snorting heroin for a while when I was in MCC New York.
How'd you get hold of it?
Well, some guy came in and he had a bunch of heroin inserted in a body cavity. He'd been arrested at the airport on an old warrant, and they didn't know, and they just brought him there. And sure enough, he had this package of heroin that kept everybody high for weeks. Yeah, it's a big problem in prison. In fact, we just finished doing a documentary for HBO with the magazine called Prison Life Presents Prisoners of the War on Drugs. And what we show in the documentary is how the drug economy really rules the prison as well as it does the streets.
I would imagine it's a pretty frightening prospect, the idea of getting addicted to a hard drug while you're in prison, because you're not going to have necessarily a reliable source.
Well, that's actually not true. The fact is that there are drugs are readily available in just about every prison in the United States, maybe even more so than they are on the street, but at least as much as in the street. They're more expensive, and people do get in problems because if they don't pay their debts, it's kind of hard to hide from who they owe the money. But we did an interview with one guy in a state prison who was telling us how he made $4,000 a week selling drugs in prison.
How much were you willing to pay during the period that you were snorting heroin?
Well, I didn't pay anything, actually. I never became addicted to it. I
mean, were you owed a favor or something?
No, it was just passed out. It was just guy was just handing it out to people and sharing it.
Looking for new customers?
No. I mean, I think he was as surprised as anyone else to be there and have all this heroin. And he thought, well, I've got it. I might as well give it to some of these guys. Maybe it was his way of trying to make friends.
Now, you did 8 years. Did your way of spending time in prison change over that 8 years?
Not drastically, no. It changed from one institution to another, depending on the conditions of the institution and the job that I would end up getting. But by and large, it stayed the same. You know, I did a lot of meditating, reading, and trying very hard to kind of go inside my own character and personality and find out, if I could, what it was that led me to end up in prison.
Now, what's it like to try to meditate, or I should say even to learn to meditate, when you're behind bars?
It's tough. And what I used to have to do is I would wake up very early in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, and try to meditate at that time when it was, when you got some quiet, a habit that stayed with me ever since. I still get up at that hour.
Did you have your own cell?
I did a lot of the time that I was locked up, because I was in maximum security, and I was in the early 80s. Before they became so unbelievably overcrowded. In fact, just as I was getting out in 1990 is when the prison population just was going so fast it couldn't keep up with new construction.
Did you have to meditate when other people were sleeping during the periods when you shared cells with other people? I'm wondering, you know, you have to watch your back. It's probably not wise to close your eyes and think about your breath when there's other people who, I don't know, might try to take advantage of you.
I didn't find that. I didn't find a lot of threat when I was in prison, either sexual threat or violent threat. By and large, I think because I avoided the type of activities in prison that lead to that.
Like what?
Well, homosexuality, it was one of the biggest problems, and you get stuck and caught in these homosexual triangles or something like that. That's a lot of killings take place over that. Gambling is another. People get run up big gambling bills and can't pay. And another would be drugs. I mean, buying drugs and without having the money available. I never bought any drugs while I was in prison. If people gave them to me, I would use them from time to time, marijuana anyway. So I avoided those kinds of activities, and gambling, drugs, and homosexuality. Those are the things that get most people in trouble in prison.
Richard Stratton is the editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. Tomorrow we'll hear from the publisher of a newspaper by and for cops. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Richard Stratton, editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. Like several of the staff members, he's an ex-con. He'll tell us about the 8 years he served for smuggling marijuana. And we hear about last night's Emmy Awards and this fall's TV season from TV critic David Bianculli. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Richard Stratton, editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine, a publication advertised as the voice of the convict. In the first part of our talk, Stratton described the magazine and told us a little bit about his own experiences in prison. He served 8 years for smuggling marijuana. Were there prisoners that scared you?
Yeah, there were a lot of prisoners that scared me. Some of them scared me because I just felt that they were so, what should I say? I mean, they didn't scare me personally. What scared me about them was the how far they had gone from ever being able to change, I guess. Although I think that everybody has that capacity. Some of them just because of their backgrounds, because of the way they'd been brought up, even people with a lot of talents and a lot of skills, I just didn't see how they were ever going to be able to break out of the kind of syndrome that they were in, the crime and then reincarceration.
What was it like for you to be incarcerated with the people who you were usually protected from? You know, when you were outside, you were protected from the hardened criminals who were inside. When you were inside, you were living with them.
I think the thing that strikes most people, and certainly the fellow who directed the film, Mark Levin, who directed the film for HBO, one of the things that he commented on was how struck he was by the fact that the people that he met in prison seemed very much like people that he would have as friends and acquaintances on the street. The war on drugs has changed the nature of the prison population tremendously in America. A lot of people are going to prison for drug offenses who would not ordinarily be involved in any kind of criminal activity. So you have a lot of different people who are in prison. 70% of the people in prison in this country are there for drugs or drug-related crimes. And it's probably even higher than that when you think of the robbers who do it for drug habits. So the surprising thing, I think, about prison is how ordinary the people really are. Most Americans think that, oh, these horrible animals that, you know, they're just crazy, and if we let them out, they're going to rob, rape, and pillage. And it's just not true. A lot of them are just normal people. They're husbands, wives, brothers, and sisters, and they just got in trouble, and they ended up in prison.
Do you feel you were changed in prison?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I was out and living the life of a marijuana smuggler, there was a lot of hubris involved in that. I was very successful for quite a while and made a lot of money and began to think that, although it was always kind of a political statement on my part too, we stuck strictly with marijuana. We wouldn't touch any other drugs because we felt that, you know, hard drugs have bad karma. I mean, it was a hippie who came up through that whole school. But what it did, what my college education in prison was really, as I said, one of the kind of inner trip, the inner voyage, the discovery of, you know, who you really are. Because you're stripped of everything. There you are in your jumpsuit like everybody else. And you spend a lot of time thinking, you spend a lot of time on your own in your cell or surrounded by other people, but you're alone. That was another thing that was so amazing about it is the loneliness. It's incredibly lonely in prison because you're taken away from all the people you love and the people that you were close to on the street, but yet you're constantly surrounded by people. So it's the loneliness of the crowd. But yeah, I do feel as though I learned a lot about my own kind of anti-authoritarian motivations, and I've tried now to channel those anti-authoritarian impulses into creative works, writing, and the magazine.
As opposed to
smuggling pot.
Is your experience an example of the transformation that, the possibilities of transformation that prison can offer?
Yeah, I think so, although I would qualify that by saying that everything is going against that happening for most people in prison because of the conditions of the way prison is going now. When I was locked up in the early 80s, it was different. I was able to take college courses. I was able to try to do a lot of different things to improve myself. I was came in contact with this Siddha yoga group that came in and taught meditation, which is what got me started meditating. All that stuff has stopped now. All the programs have stopped. The wardens are lamenting it. Everybody is upset about it who knows about criminal justice, because these are the only things that work. If a person who's in prison has an opportunity to change and is given some kind of guidance, a lot of them will do it, because people don't really want to come back to prison. People don't really want to be criminals. So, but that's all changing now. It's now the idea is just lock them up, throw away the key, punish them, make it worse and worse. And what's going to happen, I'm afraid, is that there's going to be a tremendous backlash. The prisons in this country are going to end up like Attica of 25 years ago. And what we're going to have is we're going to have a lot of very disturbed, very bitter, very vengeful, violent people coming out of prison and wreaking havoc in our streets.
Did you spend a lot of time trying to observe how different prisoners with different temperaments dealt with the loneliness, dealt with some of the indignities that they faced, dealt with their anger?
Yes, of course. I mean, that's the thing that I think was the most interesting for me, was just to observe all these men who, by and large, the men who go to prison tend to be either they're very bright and very ambitious guys from the ghetto who just never had an opportunity. Maybe they didn't play basketball, or maybe they didn't have the Mike Tyson's athletic ability, so they went into crime. And because that was basically the only other thing that was available to them. And to see how those people, by and large, those minorities, Hispanic, Latino, and Black, African-American, and other minorities, how they would deal with the anger and frustration of the prison environment. And then, of course, to compare that with when I was in MCC New York, which is probably the most fascinating prison I was in. You'd see people like big bond traders come in there, and international spies. I mean, they've got these the Muslims who supposedly blew up the World Trade Center down there now, the radical sheikh. And so you'd see all kinds of different people coming through MCC New York, and that's usually shortly after they'd been arrested. So to see the way they dealt with the shock of incarceration was fascinating.
Make some comparisons for us.
Well, let's say the average organized crime figure comes into prison, and for him, it's a kind of retirement on the installment plan. All his pals are there or have been there. They've usually got their whole section of the prison staked out, their tiers, where they live, and where the best foods, best in-cell cooking takes place on those tiers. And they usually control the kitchen. And, for them, prison has been a part of their heritage or their lifestyle for so many years now that it's not alien to them at all. So they would walk in with a kind of a swagger and, huggings and kissings of their fellow organized crime people, and be immediately welcomed right in, whereas you might get a white-collar bond trader or somebody like that who comes in and is just, like, terrified or fascinated or amazed at what he is about to go through. And then, you have the people who come from overseas, a lot of them in American prisons. I remember Colombians who were crying because they were going to get released from prison and have to go back to Colombia, where they couldn't make in a year what they made in a month in working in the factories in the prisons, which was really only about maybe $100 a month, $150 a month, but at home they maybe made $60 a year. So that was another kind of reaction. Life for them was worse at home than it was in prison, as far as economically. They could send money home to their families. So there's a whole range of responses to prison life. I can remember people killing themselves. I mean, I can remember seeing one guy hang himself in his cell because he couldn't stand it. And other people, to them, it was like natural. It was more. They were more at ease in prison than they ever would be on the streets.
Who does that describe?
Well, it describes these unfortunate people who've usually come from impoverished backgrounds, grew up on the streets, broken homes, 13 kids, 12 of them running around in the street, and mom doesn't know where anybody is. And, you know, they're in trouble from an early age, what we call state-raised, in and out of reform schools. So for them, prison is no big deal. It's you know, that's why it's so crazy, these ideas that we're going to scare these people and we're going to deter them. They're so hard and so tough, you know, from growing up on the streets. There's nothing that's going to, no punishment that's going to make these people see the light. The only thing that's going to help them is education.
My guest is Richard Stratton, the editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Stratton is my guest, and he's the editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. He did time in prison from 1982 to 1990 for smuggling marijuana. How have you seen prisons change since you were in prison? And tell us the years that you were in.
I was in from 82 to 90. And the way I saw them change while I was there was I was in the federal system, so in the beginning, it was there was more sort of what I would call the upper echelons of crime, a lot less street criminals. But as the drug war escalated, and as we started, as the federal government started enforcing the drug laws from the DEA on down, we saw a lot more of these sort of crack dealers and crack addicts and junkies and street people who ordinarily would have ended up in the state system come into the federal system. A lot of younger people. The other thing that's changed probably the most dramatically since the time that I was locked up was the number of women who came into the system. The women's prison population is growing at 10 times the rate of the men's prison population. Again, largely as a result of the war on drugs. So that was I was there to see this huge boom in the prison population. It went from, I think, around 30,000. Well, it tripled in those years.
Did you find there was something of a generation gap between the newcomers and the people who had been there before?
Yeah, there is, and it's something that's constantly written about in the magazine. These old-time convicts will write in and talk about how they can't stand these new jitterbugs that are coming in and making so much noise and creating so many problems for the older, more settled prisoners. And recently I've been working with some people who are doing a film about doing away with the education programs in prison. And we saw an interview recently with an old-time convict who talked about when he first came into prison, how some of the older brothers took him aside and taught him how to deal with prison life and also how to change. It was kind of a mentoring program that was going on, a think tank that they had in Attica and Green Haven, some of the other maximum security prisons in this country, before they had any kind of educational programs.
You're now editing a magazine about prison life. When you were in prison, did you do a lot of reading?
Yes, I did. I read constantly. And a lot of writing, too. I wrote a novel that was published in just the same year that I got out of prison.
Is it the first novel you'd written, first book you'd written?
No. I had written a couple of novels before that, but nothing that I'd ever tried to get published. I was a writer before I went to prison, so I've been published in Rolling Stone and a variety of different magazines. High Times magazine I was involved with from the very beginning. So I was a writer when I went to prison. It wasn't as though I started writing in prison.
What kind of books did you read? Did your taste change?
I don't think it did, no. I read everything from Dostoevsky, which I'd read most of his stuff before I was locked up, but then I reread all his prison stuff, Notes from the House of the Dead. And I read all of the various prison writers, Melville, Jack London, all of our great American writers who had been formed somewhat by their prison experiences, because I saw that as something that was happening to me. And a lot of fiction, read an awful lot of fiction, which has always been kind of the thing that I enjoy writing the most. And just about anything I could get my hands on.
Was it hard for you to find work when you got out of prison? I know, you know, now you're editing Prison Life magazine. Before that, you edited a publication for a prisoners' rights advocacy group.
Mm-hmm.
But was it difficult, or would it have been difficult, do you think, for you to work in places that weren't related to prison?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was fortunate. I became, as I said, a jailhouse lawyer when I was locked up, and I had written an appeal that ultimately got me out. So I was contacted and got in touch with a lawyer, a criminal lawyer here in New York, who actually hired me 2 days after I was out of prison to write briefs, and then I ended up being what we called a forensic specialist, where I would marshal evidence for trials and stuff like that. And I second-seated him at a number of criminal trials before moving on to get back to writing, because I felt that I loved the job and it was fascinating. In fact, I was going to go to law school and try to practice law myself, and then I realized that if I did that, that would be the end of my writing career. So I quit working at the attorney's office and went back to writing and editing. So it was easy for me, but to answer your question, for the average person, it's very difficult. We're coming out with, the stigma of ex-convict attached to you. It's really hard.
As an ex-convict, are there rights that you don't have?
There are a number of rights that you don't have. And in some states, ex-convicts are not allowed to vote. They're not supposed to vote in national elections. You're not allowed to possess firearms naturally. Although naturally, I say that naturally. I mean, and naturally in that it's such a well-known law, although I don't agree with that either. And there are other civil disabilities. You can't hold any kind of civil service jobs. You can't get a lot of state licenses. There are all kinds of things that crop up like that. It's tough to get loans. It's tough to get any kind of thing that depends on a history.
Since you didn't think that smuggling marijuana should be a crime, were you particularly angry that you were in prison?
No, I wasn't angry that I was in prison, because all of the time that I was out there doing it, I realized that I was doing something that was illegal, and if I got caught, I was going to have to go to prison. So I'm a great subscriber, and don't do the crime if you can't do the time. However, I was upset that I got so much time for refusing to basically snitch on other people, some of whom were innocent, by the way. There were some people who were famous friends of mine that the government was really after, who were not involved in any way except that they knew about my activities. So that was what really upset me, was the whole snitch system of justice. They virtually told me if I were willing to cooperate and testify against other people, they would set me free. And I thought that was altogether wrong. On the one hand, they're saying it's such a serious crime, we're going to give you 25 years with no parole. On the other hand, they're saying snitch and we'll let you go. So, you know, that's a very curious and confusing message that we're sending to people.
Do you think there'll ever be a point in your life where you want to stop thinking about prison altogether?
You know, I've thought about that a lot, actually, and sometimes I say to myself, you know, how am I ever going to leave this experience behind while I'm doing this? But it took 8 years out of my life, and it made such a deep, deep impression on me. It had caused such profound changes in my life that I don't think it's anything that I want to walk away from completely, no. I married a woman who spent time in prison. Most of my friends are ex-convicts. I think it's kind of like going through a war with someone, and you bond in a curious kind of way, and that experience, you can never leave that experience behind. I think it's a bad thing to not deny our histories.
Richard Stratton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Richard Stratton is the editor and publisher of Prison Life magazine. Tomorrow we'll hear from the publisher of a newspaper by and for cops. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. Traditionally, the new TV season begins the day after the Emmy Awards telecast, but this year there's a one-week gap between last night's awards and the official start of the 1995-96 TV season. Even so, TV critic David Bianculli has a lot to say, not only about the new series being sneak previewed in the next few days, but about last night's Emmys.
Oh, how they try and soften it, of course. No more, and the winner is. Now it's just, the Emmy goes to. But we all know who the Emmy goes to. The winner. The Emmy goes to the winner. There, I said it. When they break the screen into those little boxes and you see all the nominees and they announce the winner, all the others go away. I say, let's leave those faces up there. Let's see them during the acceptance speech. Let's see them in the car on the way home. After 47 years of hearing who got thanked, it's about time we heard who got blamed. I'd like to blame the Academy. I'd like to blame my agent, my manager, the people I work with, my family. They're all against me.
Jerry Seinfeld was right last night when he gave that little speech. At the Emmys, like at any award show, there are winners and there are losers. One thing I couldn't understand about last night, though, was how the losers won in the end. In the comedy category, that didn't happen. In comedy, Candace Bergen of Murphy Brown won for Best Actress, and Christine Baranski of Sybil won Best Supporting Actress, and all the other key awards went to Frasier. Kelsey Grammer got Best Actor, David Hyde Pierce got Best Supporting Actor, and the show also won for Best Writing and Best Directing. So at the end of the night, which show won Best Sitcom? Frasier. Makes sense, right? Now look what happened over in the drama series category. Mandy Patinkin of Chicago Hope wins for Best Actor. Kathy Baker of Picket Fences wins for Best Actress. And Ray Walston, also of Picket Fences, wins Best Supporting Actor. Juliana Margulies of ER wins Best Supporting Actress. And ER also wins for Best Writing and Best Direction. So what wins as Best Drama Series? NYPD Blue. Even though, according to the votes just tabulated, it doesn't have the best of anything. This year, obviously, a lot of Emmy votes were cast against certain shows rather than for them. They weren't about to let ER win too much. But enough about last night. Let's talk about the next 6 days, when 15 new fall series are given sneak previews between tonight and Sunday. Then again, let's not talk about all of them, because there are only a few worth sampling. Tonight's Fox sitcoms, Partners and Ned and Stacy, aren't bad, because they've got good casts, led by John Cryer in Partners and Thomas Hayden Church in Ned and Stacy. On Wednesday, the ABC sitcom The Naked Truth is pretty bad, but it's got Tia Leone, who's very good. At any rate, the week's best new sitcom, also on ABC on Wednesday, is The Drew Carey Show. It's got the best jokes, the best cast, and, in Carey, a comedy star waiting to happen. Here he is returning home to find three of his friends waiting there, just in time for him to unload on them.
Come on, ask me about my day, I dare you.
Alrighty, Drew, how was your day?
You're not sincere enough.
You!
You ask me about my day.
Okay, Drew, how was your day?
So you want to know how my day was, huh? It was lousy. It was like the rubber glove part of a physical exam.
Ooh. That's a bad day.
Oh my God, what happened?
Oh, some crazy woman I interviewed complained to my boss and I got reamed.
You, Mr. Employee of the Month?
Hey, you're damn right I'm Employee of the Month. You know why? Because I do my job well, and I treat everyone fairly. This woman called me a sexist. You know how many forms you have to fill out when someone calls you a sexist?
8.
Two other shows are worth mentioning this week. One is Friday's Strange Luck on Fox, which is a good companion piece to The X-Files. If you like The X-Files, tuning in an hour early to catch D.B. Sweeney in Strange Luck is a good move. And if you want to catch an early taste of the new primetime soap by Darren Star, the guy who created Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place, tune to CBS Wednesday for Central Park West. It's as guilty a pleasure as Melrose Place, and the first two episodes of Central Park West draw you in quickly. Mariel Hemingway is the nice lady editor recently moved to New York. Ron Liebman is the nasty publisher. And Machen Amick, who played Shelley on Twin Peaks, is the publisher's even nastier stepdaughter and society columnist. It's fun to watch. But the real quality TV premieres this fall arrive next week, when the season starts for real. That's when new shows called Murder One and American Gothic come to town. As they say on TV, see you next week.
David Bianculli is the TV critic for the New York Daily News. One program you're likely to run into in the new season is Caroline in the City. NBC has given it a prized spot in between Seinfeld and ER. The show co-stars Malcolm Getz as a cartoonist's assistant. Now, I don't know how the series is, but I can tell you he sings well. He starred in a recent revival of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. From the cast recording of the revival, here's Malcolm Getz singing the best-known song from the show, Old Friends.
Here's to us,
who's like us, damn few. Hey, old friend, are you okay? Old friend, what do you say? Old friend, are we or are we unique? Time goes by, everything else keeps changing. You and I, we get continued next week. Most friends fade, or they don't make the grade. New ones are quickly made, and in a pinch, sure, they'll do. But us, old friend, what's to discuss? Old friend, here's to us, who's like us, damn few. So, old friend, fill me in slow. Old friend, start from hello. Old friend, I want the when, where, and how. Old friends do tend to become old habit.
Old Friends, from the recent revival of Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along, starring Malcolm Getz. You can see him on the new series Caroline in the City right after Seinfeld, beginning next week. In the Small World department, Jason Alexander, who plays George on Seinfeld, was featured in the original production of Merrily. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.